You ever get the feeling that everything in America is completely f***ed up?
Now, they're saying I shouldn't think stuff like this. They're saying
something is wrong with me.
Practice.
Let's hop back in that time machine and go back to 1991, where we left off last week with the discussion of rap music. But before we get into the topic of this week, in jest, you know, we're going to continue looking at the music of 1991, the trends, the where music was headed, where it was at the time, and where it was going, and where it was going, really. As I sat down and started formulating the idea for this part two of this episode, I realized that while 91 laid the groundwork, 92 and 93 were really the catalyst for change in the music industry. And we'll get more into that here in a second. But just to recap of what was going on in 1991, because, you know, everyone remembers, you know, everyone always asks, where were you when Kennedy was shot? Where were you when the Space Shuttle Challenger blew up? Where were you when Pee Wee Herman was caught masturbating in an adult theater?
I don't remember that. Surprise! I thought maybe you were going to say, where were you when the Gulf War broke out? But the Pee Wee thing, it just kind of came. Yeah. I don't think I could pinpoint it.
What about, where were you when Jeffrey Dahmer was arrested?
Jeffrey Dahmer, you know, I said I moved from Hawaii to Kentucky in January of 92. And I remember Dahmer being in the news when I got to Kentucky. So I don't know, were his crimes at the end of 91, or was he arrested?
They were during the summer.
The summer?
I know that, yeah. Because I remember coming in, I was outside, probably skateboarding at the time, because that was when 91 is when I had started trying to be a skateboarder, and 91 was also the year that I realized that I was not going to be a professional skateboarder. But I remember coming in, my dad saying, oh, did you hear Jeffrey Dahmer got out of jail? Cost him an arm and a leg, but he got out. And I missed the humor at first and went, are you kidding me? What is wrong with our justice system? Mm-hmm. But then he's like, oh, well, you know what Pee Wee's favorite drink is? Jack and Squirt.
I'm just going to leave that there. You can have that.
Yeah. Anyway, so other news going on in 1991. Silence of the Lamb swept the Oscars. The one of the only, I think, handful of movies, I'm probably wrong, that won director, picture, screenplay, and actor.
Yeah, and three. There's three of them.
Okay.
It Happened One Night and One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest. Picture, director, actor, actress, screenplay.
Yeah. Liz Taylor married for the seventh time. Do you remember who to?
Was that the seventh? Was Larry Fortensky?
Larry Fortensky. And where did they meet? In rehab, but not celebrity rehab.
That's just right.
Yeah.
Was that her? Well, was it seventh? Okay. For some reason, I thought she was married eight times.
Well, hubby number seven.
The two marriages to Richard Burton. Okay.
Yeah. And then, you know, just looking at the last week, we looked at the musical charts, but before we get into what was going on in 91 in music, do you remember what the big movies of 1991 were?
Well, we already talked about the
soundtracks.
Yeah. Terminator 2 would have probably been one of the biggest movies that year.
That was number one.
Okay. I remember, because you know what's so funny? And that was the last summer I lived in Hawaii, and I vividly remember I went to the movies every week that summer. I didn't intentionally try to do it, but I vividly remember going to the movies every week. But as far as trying to recall, I remember seeing Mobsters with Christian Slater.
So shockingly, not in the top 10.
I remember seeing, would have been Child's Play 3, maybe?
91,
when where Andy's in the military school.
Yes.
I remember seeing that. I remember seeing one of my favorite Jean-Claude Van Damme.
Actually, I think Child's Play 3 was like 93 or 94. So
okay, maybe it was Child's Play 2 then. My favorite Jean-Claude Van Damme movie came out that year. It was Double Impact. I believe that was in 91.
Okay, well, let's look at the top 10. Okay, tell me if you saw any of these.
Okay.
Number 10 was Naked Gun 2.5, The Smell of Fear.
Oh, wow. No, I didn't see that.
Number 9, I'm sure this is high on your list, Father of the Bride.
Okay, I remember it coming out.
Number 8, Sleeping with the Enemy.
I actually did see that. Yeah.
Number 7, you know, he was too legit to quit.
Adam's Family?
The Adam's Family, yes.
Was number saw that in the drive-in, yeah.
Number 6 is Hook.
I saw that in an airplane, yeah. I don't remember anything about it.
I was just reading the other day something about this movie where apparently there's a couple that is kissing on a bridge. And I'm guessing off kind of in the background. Mm-hmm. It's an uncredited George Lucas and Carrie Fisher. Did not know that.
And isn't that like one of Gwyneth Paltrow's first movies too, right?
I believe so. Yeah. Okay. Because who is her godfather?
Her godfather? Was it Spielberg? No.
It's a little guy named Steven Spielberg. Yeah. Okay. So, okay. You know, Gwyneth Paltrow has really worked hard too.
Oh, stop.
Number 5 was City Slickers.
Oh, you know what? I do remember seeing that in the theater. And like we just took a chance on it and it wound up being like really, really fun. Like it was because it was safe. Like there was not a foul language. But it was just really cute. And then all the stuff with Norm and the calf, you know. I don't know, we're high school kids and I'm pretty sure it came out over the summer, didn't it? Yeah.
Most likely, yeah. Number 4 was Silence of the Lambs, as we mentioned, swept the Oscars.
I saw that in the theater.
Number 3, the only animated movie to be nominated for a Best Picture movie. Oscar, Beauty and the Beast.
I didn't see that until the 25th anniversary screening.
And number 2, everything he does, he'll do with a fake English accent. Robin Hood, Prince of Thieves.
Okay. I think I saw that at a drive-in and it was, and yeah, I don't remember a whole lot about it.
If you remember, back on January, we had a lot of pop, little adult contemporary with Bette Midler and Surface. Ralph Transfit, which, sidebar, segue, we discussed Suzanne Vega on the last episode because she was at the beginning of 1991, she had the song Tom's Diner, which she featured on. On my way to work the day that we were recording this, I heard Luca while I was listening to an old Casey Kasem, the top 100 hits of 1987.
87, okay.
Yeah, Luca came on. One, it's a lot poppier than I remember it. And two, I did not realize it was about child abuse.
Yeah.
My name is Luca. I live on the second floor. I live upstairs from you. Yes, I think you've seen me before. If you hear something late at night, some kind of trouble, some kind of fright, just don't.
So, way to bring me down, Suzanne Vega, as I'm on my way to work. But yes, that's a song that, yeah, I didn't really pay.
Remember?
I mean, I remember it, but it wasn't in my
video was on
genre.
A lot.
Yeah. So.
I mean, that put her on the map a little bit. I don't know if she didn't have too many, but she still had a nice little career out of it. You know,
yeah, I'm sure she rode that in Tom's Diner straight to county fairs all over the place.
Yeah, she's playing at the Largo, probably. Yeah. Yeah.
All right, well, now we fast forward to the summertime. Summertime.
Summer.
And let's look at what is the top 10 songs of June 8th, 1991. At number 10, still kicking around. I had him confused with someone else who was on the countdown earlier. But number 10, we had The Power of Love / Love Power, Luther Vandross.
I put that on one of my list of songs to pay attention to. But yeah, I mean, that'd be one of his biggest hits, wasn't it? Yeah.
I would think so. Although I can't recall the song at the moment.
Oh, okay.
Just like I can't remember number 9, Miracle by Whitney Houston.
I do not remember that one.
Now, what was unbelievable, it's the number 8 song by EMF.
Unbelievable. Was that Nice Clay?
I think
Didn't they sample that? They lifted that for the song? I could be wrong.
Do you remember High Five coming in at number 7 with I Like the Way? The Kissing Game.
The Kissing Game. That was like, yeah, so that was her first album. That was her first single. And it was kind of, you know, there was a little bit of a gap in the boy bands, right? NKOTB was sort of...
NKOTB had the highest grossing tour of 1990, the second highest grossing tour ever behind the Rolling Stones at the time.
1990? Oh, yeah. Okay. All those teenagers at the mall that were... But then there was like, you said, the New Edition guys had broken up and made their solo albums. And then you had this new sort of batch, and High Five was one of the ones that was going to be so good. And then, yeah, nothing really came out of them.
Number 6, Losing My Religion, R.E.M., the song that swept the VMAs that year. Yeah.
Probably on the charts for a long time, yeah. I guess. Yeah.
Number 5, Love is a Wonderful Thing by Michael Bolton.
Yeah.
Why aren't Michael Bolton and Kenny G just touring together every year?
Mm-hmm. Top 5 now.
Yeah. Number 4, I Don't Want to Cry by Mariah Carey.
And that's fascinating because that's still off her first album. So her first album came out in 1990. That would have been like the fourth single off that album. She's still in the charts in 91. And then the Emotions album comes out like in the fall of 91. Like she was cranking them out. Yeah. And still turning out hit after hit off these albums. Yeah.
Number 3 is Paula Abdul's Rush Rush, most famous for
the Keanu Reeves in the music video that was spoof of, or a takeoff of Rebel Without a Cause. Yeah. Yes.
I was very disappointed when I saw Paula this summer and Keanu Reeves did not show up during that song.
Yeah.
Number 2, as we discussed on the last episode, the hit off the New Jack City soundtrack, I Want to Sex You Up by Color Me Bad.
You couldn't go anywhere that summer without hearing that song on the radio or seeing the video. Yeah, that was pretty popular.
And the number 1 song of June 8th, my least favorite song by my favorite band, More Than Words by Extreme. It's not that I dislike the song. It's just that I remember when Extreme's second album, Pornograffiti, or Pornograffiti, depending on how you emphasize the syllables, came out in the fall of 90. I bought it, and my friends were like, why are you buying this band? Who's Extreme? No one cares. You know, this crazy band. And then More Than Words hits, and everybody has the song. Everybody's got the single. It swept. You know, there are so many prom dates that probably got lucky to that song.
That was all over dial-in TV, if I remember correctly. That summer, people were calling that one in a lot.
I when I did interview the band in 1995, bassist Pat Badger did say that was his favorite video to make.
Because he wasn't in it?
Because all he had to do was sit in a chair.
Yeah. I do remember that part.
Now, segueing off of that, because Extreme is a band that gets lumped in with hair metal and glam because, yes, Gary Cherone and Nuno Bettencourt did have some fine locks of hair. But if anybody who has actually listened to a whole Extreme album, the second, third, fourth, or fifth album, will know that they have their musical style is very varied. Mucho varied. And is more in line with Queen, who is a big influence, than, let's say, Van Halen, even though Gary Cherone did jam with Van Halen a few years later. But going off of the hair metal tangent, hair metal was a genre that was well represented in 1991, but not by bands that you would really... bands that are probably... fondly remembered by anyone other than hair band aficionados.
Okay.
And we'll get to that more in a minute. First, let me reintroduce my guest host for this week, Mike DeKalb, the hockey transplant from www.hockeytransplant.com, on Twitter at Mike DeKalb. Do you want to go ahead and plug your hockey blog real quick?
You just did it right there, hockeytransplant.com.
Well, tell people what you have. You've just recently relaunched the blog.
I'm
the Golden Knight bandwagon.
I'm excited. It's that today they just did rookie. They got players doing an unofficial practice, and the first players are starting to report to training camp. And training camp starts next week. The first game, preseason games, are in 2 weeks, week and a half, and then the season starts in a month. You know, and so I'm excited. It gets a chance to watch the newest. Hockey team and to be a fan from day one, so I'm excited about that. But I'm here to talk about music. Thank you for having me back. All
right. And I am your host, Chad Smart, on Twitter at Chad Smart. Now, going back to the end of our last episode on rap and hip hop, you started discussing the biggest probably collaboration in rap and hip hop was between a very influential rap band and a very non-rap band.
Influential, nonetheless.
Influential, and still out there today. Probably one of the biggest bands in their genre.
Sure. But you figured, I mean, and I guess they toured together at one point, but during the late 80s, when Anthrax was known for, you know, especially Scott Ian from Anthrax would perform with Public Enemy t-shirts, Public Enemy sticker on his guitar, mm-hmm. and then Public Enemy did a song called Bring the Noise, which featured a line part of the song they were shouting out other hip-hop groups that they liked, but they also had a line that said Wax is for Anthrax. And so there was sort of mutual admiration between each other, and then they kind of decided, hey, maybe let's redo Bring the Noise, but with both bands performing.
Now, if Anthrax and Wax did not rhyme, would we have had this collaboration?
Interesting thought. Yeah, I don't know. Or,
I mean, you know, it's all, you know, you never know. It could have been, you know, if it would have been like, I want to be a singer just like the guy from Winger.
Okay.
We could have got a Public Enemy Winger collaboration.
No one needs that. No. Winger might be in that group of artists that you were just talking about that in 1991 probably was making albums and you wish they weren't.
And speaking of mashups, for anyone who doesn't follow Positive Cynicism on Facebook, there was a mashup when the last episode was posted that I never knew that I wanted until it happened, and that is Bell Biv Devo.
Oh, yes.
Yes, I want to. If anyone out there is DJ inclined, I want a mashup of Whip It and Doomy. Anyway, we're going off on tangents. Yeah, so Anthrax and Public Enemy did their cover of Bring the Noise, which was featured on Anthrax Attack of the Killer Bees album.
And it was featured on Public Enemy's album Apocalypse 91 that year, too.
Same year.
Yeah.
Interesting. I did not know that.
Yeah, yeah.
Because I would have thought it would have came out like a year or two at least earlier to...
Well, because I mean, the original version of Bring the Noise would have been, I think, 88?
Oh, so the collaboration was on...
The collaboration was on. It was on the Anthrax version was also on the Public Enemy's album from 91, yeah.
We can look at it now and say that was probably very influential in not the early 90s so much, but the music that came towards the end of the 90s.
Sure.
With the rap metal,
I'm sure, you know what I immediately think of? Alien Ant Farm.
Okay.
Remember when they did Smooth Criminal? You know, that kind of thing. I'm sure
they were the Ugly Kid Joe of that genre.
Yeah. It seemed like that was, that rap. Because it was basically taking an R&B song, right, and doing a kind of a quote-unquote metal version of it. Because, I mean, Korn and Limp Bizkit and them weren't covering rap songs, but they were all, Korn and... Korn had songs with Ice Cube, and actually Korn did they did Wicked, the Ice Cube song, that was on they did a cover of that on one of their early albums. So yeah, I think there are definitely some of those bands, because I think you said when Korn first came out they were such a hard metal band, but yet they had, I think there's a lot of fans of theirs that also listen to rap music, and that's what kind of launched some of these. I think there's a lot of people who were listening to Anthrax. I know I was. We saw the Public Enemy t-shirt and the stickers, and we were like, oh, I wonder what they sound like. And I'm sure there might be some Public Enemy fans who might have heard Wax is for Anthrax and then said, who are they? Because they're both from New York City. Mm-hmm. But, and I'm wondering if... I'm guessing there probably a lot of people listen to both bands.
Yeah, I had a friend in high school who wore... I think every time I saw him was sporting a Public Enemy t-shirt or a Malcolm X shirt. Mm-hmm. He was also white, which was very confusing at the time, but... You know, like you said, if it...
Good enough for Marky Mark did it, too. So.
Well, I got nothing for that. But Anthrax, being one of what they consider the top four thrash bands, the other, I guess you can say the number one, is Metallica, who in 1991, if you want to be completely cynical, as I'm going to be right now, you can say that they kind of 1991 was the start of their selling out period, to which Lars Ulrich will say, well, yeah, we sold out Madison Square Garden, we sold out Dodger Stadium, we sold out arenas all around the world.
Yeah.
Touche. But they released the Black Album in the summer of 2001 or 91, and It's a very good album. It's a great album, but it was a very different album from the 80s Metallica.
Mm-hmm.
Part of that is probably due to bringing in producer Bob Rock, who had worked with a lot of the hair bands, Motley Crue, I believe Bon Jovi, Aerosmith. But it was more taking down the thrash element and making a more melodic, if you will, mm-hmm. album.
Oh, what I always found interesting about that was, they always claim so proudly, like they sold millions of albums and they never got played on the radio, yeah. And they never had a video on MTV. And then when Injustice for All came out, I think it was 88, Christmas, I got that cassette for Christmas of 88.
I believe 88.
And then they released that one video, I think.
In 89.
89, right? And so the album had already been out. There was no single from that album. Then the video came out, they played it at the Grammys. Yeah. If memory serves, when the Black Album came out, the Inner Sandman video preceded the album. Like, they kind of like bought into, this is how people are doing it. We're going to drop the single first. We're going to make a video. And then I think it's one of those ones where didn't that album like ship platinum? Like, it had already gone platinum before it had even come out. Like, all the pre-orders.
See, I want to say it debuted at number one in both America and England at the same time.
Okay.
The first metal act to do so, but... Nope, I was wrong. It wasn't the Black Album. It was another album that we will talk about momentarily, which hit number one and number two in the U.S. and England at the same time.
At the same time, okay.
So,
but it was interesting. Like, I guess we can get into this. We don't consider Metallica a hair band,
no.
But those of us who were listening to hair bands, we listen to Metallica, and I think it kind of like when my buddies and I or my older sister would talk about Poison, and we wanted to brag like we were cool because we listened to Poison. You'd always inevitably have somebody who would like look down their nose at us by saying, "Oh, I listen to Metallica. Like, I listen to real metal."
And
But what was so interesting about it? Well, they were right in the sense that the hair band seemed to be more of a fad, because Metallica was around. I wouldn't say before the hair bands; they kind of rose up with the hair bands.
Yeah.
But then because they kind of refined their sound and they weren't just all about the image, they've been able to last as long as they have, right?
Yeah. Well, they have definitely modified their sound, modified their image. I remember when they cut their hair.
Mm-hmm.
It was like you would have thought the world was ending by the reaction. I remember on the back of Metal Edge magazine, they had the promotional for what was the album? Fuel? No.
Load.
Load. And one of my friends was like, "Oh, look, the new Depeche Mode album's out." And Metallica has persevered because, like you said, I don't think they buy into necessarily an image.
Mm-hmm.
And shockingly, even after suing all their fans still come back for more. So,
because the music is still strong. And I think, and what's also interesting, and I don't know if we talked about this on the last episode, the idea of the evolution of an artist and the fact that they were willing to try something different. And I don't know anybody that listened to the album they did with Lou Reed, but just last week I listened to Saint Anger. Mm-hmm. And it's not bad. It's actually halfway decent, but because it didn't sound like Metallica, people kind of dismissed it. But you got to give them credit for at least trying. Mm-hmm. And I think that's something that kind of separated themselves from those other hair bands. The only way a lot of those hair bands tried to evolve was by doing the power ballad. But then even that became a cliche.
Mm-hmm.
And Metallica never did that. Although they made on the Black Album, they put Nothing Else Matters on there, which kind of became like all of a sudden like people were getting married to that song. And that was actually, Nothing Else Matters was in the 3D movie that they just put out a couple years ago. And it's still good. The song holds up really well. And it's, which is so interesting because they didn't bother to try to just, remember, it was a formula, right? Every hair band would have a hit single, and then the second single would be the ballad.
Yeah.
And it's like Metallica didn't even try, and that song became, Nothing Else Matters became a hit, but they didn't even try. The music video is just them in the studio recording it. Like, they just didn't even bother to try to promote it, and just people kind of caught on to it.
Yeah, going back to Extreme, I believe the first single off of Pornograffiti was Decadent Dance, which didn't do anything.
Never heard of it.
The second song is More Than Words, which blows up. I'm sure if I actually had the list here in front of me of albums, you could point out all the second Mr. Big with Lean Into It, They had, I believe, the first single was Green Tinted 60s Mind, which is a great song in and of itself. I just listened to it yesterday, and the live version is a really good song, but the second song is To Be With You, which became their big hit.
What was the first single by Slaughter? Up All Night?
Up All Night.
What was the second single by Slaughter?
Fly to the Angels.
Fly to the Angels, right? You know, and I mean, Warrant did Heaven, right?
Heaven, yeah.
That was their second single?
I believe so, yeah, because Down Boys would
have
been the first.
Down Boys, yeah. And I mean, I'm sure there's probably two. I mean, I know they made those compilation albums. We used to listen to that Power Ballad CD a lot when we were in college parties and stuff. And yeah, it, like I said, it kind of sort of became a formula in that regard.
Metallica released the Black Album. And as we've discussed, and we'll get into a little bit more detail here in a minute, hair metal was kind of on its last legs at this point, without really realizing that it was on its last legs. But Metallica releases the Black Album in June, or August of 91. In September, just probably, I believe, 3 weeks later, Guns N' Roses releases two albums, Use Your Illusion 1 and 2, which, as I stated earlier, debuted at number 1 and 2 in America and in England. And, you know, I don't even consider Guns N' Roses really a hair band. I mean, Axl had the giant hair.
People,
they got lumped in, but their sound was a little dirtier, you know, a little grittier.
They were like a bar band.
Yeah, they were they were urchins living under the street, if you will.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
I mean, I think they just looked like it. They all had the long hair, but they were a little bit more kind of tatted up. I mean, they weren't wearing the leather pants as much, but I guess Axl was wearing leather pants. I think what their thing was, though, they were that sort of, like I said, like an ultimate bar band. But then I think they realized the way to get popular and exposure is to sort of be a hair band, because their video, the Welcome to the Jungle video, for lack of a better word, they looked like girls. Axl looked like a woman, and you know, that was sort of if you look at like Cinderella or Poison, they kind of looked like women.
Or Pantera back at that time.
Oh yeah, sure, absolutely. But like, and that video, I remember when the Welcome to the Jungle video, at least the first time we ever saw it, was on Headbangers Ball, right alongside those hair bands.
Yeah.
You know, and this was their way of saying, okay, we're going to come on, we're going to lump into this scene, but then we're going to show that we're actually better than all that. And then they were the ones that just, before you knew it, they were playing stadiums, right? Mm-hmm. And then Use Your Illusion was like, they just were promoting it, and it was so delayed. Yeah, surprise, surprise, Guns N' Roses had an album that was delayed and over and hyped before.
Yeah,
it came
because
out.
They would have been performing on tour for the Use Your Illusion albums before the albums even came out, because the album came out September 18th or 17th of 91, mm-hmm. July, I believe it was in July of 91, that they had the Riverport Riot.
Oh, yeah, they had a huge world tour that summer, right?
Yeah, they had a world tour. They were performing in St. Louis, which, unfortunately, I was in Florida visiting family at the time. I would have loved to have been at the show.
Would you?
I think it would have been an interesting... at the time, I probably would not have been too fond, but it would have been a story to tell. But
Riot leaving.
Yeah, being that St. Louis was the closest city for concerts that I had growing up, mm-hmm. had I been home at that time, would I have been in St. Louis? Probably not, but there's a good chance. But yes, when Axl saw somebody recording the show and security would not do anything, Axl jumped into the crowd and then went off stage and ensuing riot.
Somebody throw something at him too.
I know people were ripping out seats, and it took, I think the staff at the Riverport Amphitheater, which is now Hollywood Casino Amphitheater, I believe. Even like 2 years later, when I was at a Reba McEntire Toby Keith concert and yelled out Freebird during Toby Keith, I was instructed to, you know, don't care what you say, just don't upset the other patrons.
Calm down.
Yeah.
And the funny thing was, that wasn't even Guns N' Roses' most notorious concert. That would come a couple of years later when they toured with Metallica. Yeah. That it was sort of the end of that group.
Yeah.
Basically, that Montreal show, which I think was either 92 or 93, right? When James caught on fire. Yeah.
So with Metallica, with Guns N' Roses being kind of the flag bearers of this, again, not hair metal. And earlier in the summer of 91, you had the takeover of SoundScan, which was a new technology used to track album sales and more accurately represent what was being sold. Because prior to that, it was more of just a record store kind of jotting down how many albums they thought they sold. Mm. And I remember when the Dr. Feelgood album, Motley Crue's album, was out, it only hit number two, and Whitney Houston kept it out of the top spot. And I remember hearing an interview with Nikki Sixx saying, no, we actually sold more albums that week, but it was reported that Whitney, because one was admitting that hair metal was as big as it was.
Didn't SoundScan also factor in like radio airplay too, or no?
No, I think SoundScan is just
sales.
Yeah, just sales. But as I believe the first week that SoundScan took effect, the number one album was the sophomore album by Skid Row, Slave to the Grind. Another band that gets lumped in with hair bands, but are they really a hair? I mean, you could kind of say Sebastian Bach, lead singer, might fit, but Rachel Boland, Dave Sabo?
Maybe not.
Attitude-wise.
Yeah, because it's sort of what hair bands, what's weird about hair bands is there could have been like sub-genres within them. Because it seemed like to be a hair band, you had a certain sound.
Yeah.
It was, you know, the long hair was one thing. I don't think there were any short hair bands, now that I think about it. It was almost as if they felt they all had to have it. They had to keep up this image, right? And they all had the same sort of, there were these 4-minute, maybe 5-minute songs. They all had guitar solos. Right?
And in the vein of like Kiss, and I will say this, hopefully you can understand what I'm saying. I'm going to kind of self-censor myself, but they were the Uck Me Uck Me songs.
Okay.
Add an F, add an S.
Oh, okay.
Or
okay.
S and F, if you want to go properly.
Yeah, but it seemed like that was what was popular, because you had a lot of people, male and female especially, who were buying Poison and Motley Crue albums. And if a band like Skid Row, like, you can tell me that they were different, but I always associate them with hair metal, because I mean Skid Row, then they opened for Bon Jovi
Bon Jovi.
Yeah, they knew that was their chance to climb the charts. And what was so funny was by 1991, like you said, Guns N' Roses was a little bit different, and so I think they were still the biggest band on the planet.
Yeah.
And people wanted to have the same street cred that Metallica did, and Metallica wasn't, like I said, they weren't making the videos, they weren't kind of glammed up, and we saw where those bands I don't mean to pick on Cinderella, but like, where were they in 1991? You know, they were still kind of around, you know, but
yeah, I believe their second album came out in 1990, I believe, Heartbreak Station.
No. But you needed to be, you know, and you know, I think you and I discussed this offline before, but hair metal was a fad. And when did it start? 84?
Yeah, you know, you can look back, like Quiet Riot had the first number one heavy metal album with, I believe it was Come On, Feel the Noise. Which would have been in 83. You know, the US Festival that happened in 83 had Motley Crue, Quiet Riot.
I always think of Out of the Cellar by Rat. I think that was 84.
I believe.
You know, and then
Def Leppard's.
Pyromania was 83, right?
Pyromania was 83.
But they were like a British heavy metal band, and then they saw, ooh, this was the. They kind of caught the cusp of that, where they were still metal, but then, again, long hair. Kind of glammed, leather pants, you know, not leather pants, but like non-black.
Well, I think the other aspect too is hot lead singer.
Okay.
I mean, I understand that Sebastian Bach does have his female admirers. Axl Rose probably does too, but
sure.
You look at, you know, Jon Bon Jovi, Vince Neil, Brett Michaels, Janie Lane, and compare them to Axl Rose, James Hetfield, or
Those were just working class guys, right? Yeah. They weren't trying. You've read the Motley Crue biographies and stuff. Didn't they? A lot of them joke about wanting to get into music to get laid.
Yeah.
Right?
That was
sort of the pinnacle of the Sunset Strip. And I think that's what kind of summarized the hair metal. Like, Metallica wasn't really a Sunset Strip kind of band. Mm-hmm. I mean, they're from the Bay Area, but they were, you know. And that's what I find interesting, though, is by the time 1991 rolls around, and I was hoping you could fill me in, is what pair of bands were still making albums that were actually selling? You know?
Well, let's look at the charts, or the release charts that I have here in front of me, and see if you've heard of any of these albums. If you can tell me one song off of any of these albums.
Okay.
You know, early in the year, you had David Lee Roth's, I believe, third solo album, A Little Ain't Enough, come out. I know that I have the cassette somewhere. Couldn't tell you one song that's on the album.
I remember the Skyscraper album. That would have been his second, right?
Yeah, that would have been the second
Just Like
one.
Paradise. That would have been a year or two before.
Yeah. Then you had White Lion's third album, Main Attraction, which I do have and I think is a good album. Mm. And White Lion was my first The first band that I saw live in concert, they opened for Stryper in 1988.
I'm supposed to say, did Stryper have an album in 91? I'm sure they probably would have.
I think 90 and 92 would have been, and it would have been, I believe, Above the Law, or yeah, Above the Law, which was their more secular album. And succular, if you will.
I see what you
mean. Oh, I'm a pun master. But yeah, I like the White Lion Main Attraction album, but there's nothing on there that was a hit. Great White had Hooked, which would have been the album after Once Bitten, Twice Shy. And I couldn't tell you any song that is on that
Neither
album.
Could I.
The Bulla Boys had Freak Show, their second album, but that did nothing.
Oh, yeah, okay.
I want to say the lead single on that was Hang on St. Christopher, which when back in college when I was doing Planet Boom video show, I know we had the video and we played it a few times, but that was more due to not having any other videos to show. as I mentioned, Mr. Big had Lean Into It, which was a big album with the release of the song that I can't remember.
And
it was
with you.
It was my, what's that?
To Be With You.
To Be With You, yeah. That was the song of my girlfriend and I at the time. I bought her the single, and I was like, oh, this is our song. And
but that was a little different because that was one of the first times I remember, I mean, them and Damn Yankees, both the super groups. We hadn't seen those in the hair metal, even though To Be With You, was that Jack Blades or is it Damn Yankees?
That's Damn Yankees.
I never think of Night Rangers being a hair band, but yeah. I mean, when they made that super group, it sort of got lumped in because they were all, like I said, long-haired rockers, and it was getting played on the same radio stations, and the video was put on at the same time as the Headbangers Ball kind of a stuff, you know.
Okay, I know you're a fan of L.A. Guns.
Their first album is fantastic.
Hollywood Vampires, got anything for that one?
I can't name a song.
In July of 91, though, my favorite performer, Alice Cooper, released his Hey Stupid album, which was the follow-up to his biggest selling album in like 15, 16 years, the Trash album, which had the hit song Poison. But he released Hey Stupid, which had, on the title track, you had Slash playing guitar, Ozzy Osbourne doing backing vocals. There was another song on the album that had the guitar, the lead and rhythm guitars were Joe Satriani and Steve Vai. Bass line provided by Nikki Sixx.
Oh, really? Okay.
And it was featured in a little independent film called Wayne's World, and it's a song called Feed My Frankenstein, which he still performs. So that kind of, I don't think that was a hit song, but people know it from the
movie. But then what helped propel Trash to being a hit record? The fact that it sort of rode the crest of hair bands.
Yeah.
Because he was wearing leather pants again. Yeah. He would have been, what, 50? No, maybe...
45, 43, yeah.
Old enough where he shouldn't have been wearing leather pants.
Well,
and
he's still wearing leather pants at almost 70 years old, yeah.
But I mean, I remember Kane Roberts and Rock Doll and stuff, and, you know, where it was like, it was another one of those guys where he had been around, I guess, technically since the late 60s, right? And made a name for himself in the 70s, but then it saw an opportunity, whether it was him or the label or his manager, who said, we can kind of redefine ourselves, because that, I don't know, top of your head, who produced the Trash album? Was it somebody who... Had he worked with people who had done some collaborations with hair metal? And
I want to say, I could be wrong, I believe he's pretty much used the same producer, Ezra.
Ezra, right? Bob Ezrin?
Yeah, Bob Ezrin.
Okay.
I could be wrong on that. I don't know. My Alice Cooper knowledge has trailed off over the years. But, I mean, it's interesting because Alice, like you said, had been around since the 70s. 80 to 85 was kind of like that dark, forgotten period when he was battling alcoholism and... trying to be, I think at one point it was kind of a new wave album.
Catch it, trying to ride a trend, see? Because you figure 80 to 85 was kind of a lull when it came to heavy metal, right? You still had the post-punk stuff in the 70s, but the late 70s, Iron Maiden and Judas Priest were kind of around, and that was when you said he was still, when he did From the Inside, right?
From the Inside, was I believe it was 1980.
1980, right? Yeah. And then so what was coming out in 80, 81? I mean, even Kiss did the disco
Dynasty
album, right?
Yeah.
You know, where you had the Duran Duran, you had the new wave stuff, and Oingo Boingo, who I loved, and so that was, I think maybe was Alice trying to do that?
It could have been, yeah. Very, you know. And then, yes, in 86, you had the Constrictor album.
Constrictor.
Which had the hit single, I say hit single in air quotes, it was a song that got played a lot on MTV, the theme from Friday the 13th Part 6, he's back, the man behind the mask, which is what got me into
when Intel. When was Raise Your Fist and Yell?
That was 87.
That was the follow-up, right?
That was the follow-up album, yeah.
I remember, was it Freedom?
Freedom, yeah.
I remember that video on Headbangers Ball a lot.
And okay, so I do not remember that video at all. Yeah. I just remember buying, I think, Rip magazine and seeing an advertisement for the album and be like, oh, I have to go to the mall today and buy this album.
I had that cassette. I remember that because, like I said, it was... I remember... Do you remember MTV used to show those old videos? Like, because yeah. Alice did a couple of videos. Black Sabbath had some... With all the weird stuff going on in the background.
It's just them on a stage with...
Yeah. And so it was like, I'd heard of them because of that footage. Because they used to show... MTV used to have a show called Closet Classics Capsule. And they would show that. And then... So then it was like I said, the hair band started... And what do you want to call it, hair bands, kind of got bigger and bigger. And then it was like Alice was like, oh, okay, well, I'm metal. Maybe he was him trying to reestablish himself. And saying like, hey, you guys, all those hair bands were inspired by me. Well, I'm not seeing anything out of it. Let me go ahead and see if I can redefine myself.
And also just to give credit where credit is due, the He's Back or the Nightmare Returns tour, which was in support of Constrictor, had a bass player that we mentioned a little earlier.
Kip Winger
was the bass player who would then go on to form Winger after leaving Alice's band. So
where's Alice in 91?
In 91, like I said, he's got the Hey Stupid. In February of 92, he'll be seen in Wayne's World. But he's still big in Europe. He's still big, you know. America, he's probably touring. I think, I want to say 91 was a tour that he did with the Scorpions. And okay. Motorhead, he would probably be where he is in 2017. Yeah. He's got that status that he will always have, the fans that will always be there, but is he setting the charts on fire? No.
Yeah, and I think at the same time, hair bands were also kind of dwindling, and I think he was an unfortunate byproduct of that. And now what I was going to mention before, I mean, I don't know if you have any other hair bands to bring up.
Oh, because, I got plenty, yes.
Oh, well, go ahead. Yeah, what else do you have on there?
Well, this will segue into the fact that at this time, hair band, as we had said, by being around from 83, 84, and really you look at 85 to 88 is probably the pinnacle of when you had Bon Jovi, Slippery When Wet, Motley Crue's Theater of Pain and Girls, Girls, Girls album, Poison... had come out.
I remember Dancing Undercover by Rat. That was just hit after hit off that album, yeah.
So record labels were putting out anything that had hair and sex appeal.
Mm-hmm.
And so we got a little band called Tough. What comes around goes around.
No.
You don't know Tough and Stevie Rochelle?
No, don't know Tough.
The only thing that I can really know, that I can recommend by Tough is a song that I can't even think of the name of it right now, but they took Metallica's... And here's where I'm drawing a complete blank. The song that Kid Rock covered used as the bed for American Badass. And Tough.
Oh, Sad But True?
Sad But True. Tough used that as a song called American Hair Band, which came out, I believe, in 2001.
Okay.
And it was basically just like, hey, we're sick of grunge. Bring back all these hair bands. So,
okay. It's a fad. You can't replicate it.
Tesla had Psychotic Supper, third album.
91, okay.
In 91, which, there's nothing... I forget, like, there are a few songs that I think would have been MTV hits. Call It What You Want. It's a good album, but it's not, again, not doing anything of note. Rat, as you had mentioned earlier, they released... Rat and Roll, 81 to 91.
Okay.
So if you want to say how long had Rat been around, in 91, they're celebrating 10 years.
That is a fantastic greatest hits album. Yeah, that's a very good greatest hits album.
And then kind of along the same lines with Alice, you had Ozzy Osbourne's No More Tears, which was supposed to be the farewell album.
Yeah. Great lead single, second single, Power Ballad. Mama, I'm Coming Home, right?
Yeah. Cinderella, you asked about them earlier. They had a live album that came out.
Okay. Whenever I see live albums, I always wonder: did the artist really want to put that out, or did the artist do it because they wanted to put one of the albums towards their record contractual agreement, so they can get out of their record label or their their deal that much faster.
Yes, kind of like how Aerosmith left Geffen.
Yeah, Pearl Jam had two more albums to give to Epic, and so they put out a greatest hits and a live album and cut out of it. Yeah.
Speaking of good debut albums and then the follow up, and I believe this is it's an EP follow up, Living Color, Biscuits.
Okay.
Do you remember anything about this?
I don't remember Biscuits, because they had, the Vivid album obviously is the one that they got, and then there was they had a second album that was halfway decent. I mean, I have their greatest hits album, but I can't remember the name. Time's Up, maybe? Or no, that might be the name of the greatest hits album, but yeah.
And then we kind of mentioned this band earlier, the alien ant farm of the hair metal bands. Ugly Kid Joe released their debut EP, As Ugly As They Want to Be, which had the hit Everything About You.
And that kind of became a hit more in 92, so, right? They kind of rode the wave of some.
And then
of
it was
Grun
also
Brothers.
On, I believe it was on their follow-up album.
Yeah, I read that, yeah. Because they said it's one of the highest-selling EPs ever, because the song came out, but the full-length album wasn't out yet, so people went back and bought the EP just to get the song, yeah.
And then you had, in the fall, I believe, around October, November of 91, Motley Crue released Decade of Decadence, a greatest hits album.
How many new songs did they have? Three or four?
Three, I believe. Yeah. Angela, a version of Anarchy in the UK, and Primal Scream.
I remember the Anarchy in the UK. They made a video for that to kind of help sell the album. Yeah.
And Primal Scream as
Primal
well.
Scream
yeah.
was it, yeah.
But then it would be February of 92 when Vince Neil is either fired or quits Motley Crue, and Motley is kind of in free fall for about a year before bringing in John Corabi and putting out what I consider the best Motley Crue album.
I never heard that. I'm going to have to hear that.
And then at the end of the year, Poison releases a live album, Swallows Live. So you have Motley Crue, Poison, Rat, all releasing...
Cinderella,
yeah, all releasing non-studio albums.
Sort of to keep themselves relevant, right? I mean, I don't know if they toured that year. Maybe they might have packaged up and toured a few of them together.
Bon Jovi, Nowhere to Be Seen in 90, and the year previous, 90 would have been John Bon Jovi's solo album, the Young Guns 2 soundtrack. So I think if you look back, hair metal at this time is really, as we said, it's on its last legs, even though no one wants to admit or wants to see it. Warrant was out in support of Cherry Pie, which had come out in 90, along with Trickster and Firehouse. Again, two bands that, while I enjoy them and it was a good show, a good concert in 91, are Trickster and Firehouse going to be your flag-carrying bands?
Yeah. I mean, were they supposed to? Do you think were they promoted that way? I mean, I mean Firehouse had the one power ballad.
Spend My Life. I know this. On the second album, they had a song called Love of a Lifetime.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking of.
Which we had the video for, and we dubbed it Getting a Perm Tonight because, they had nice perms. But these were bands that, again, were probably oversaturating the market and just bands that weren't going to appeal to the wide audience. They're going to appeal to the niche hair metal, and even within the hair metal community, they're probably not regarded as great musicians or great songwriters. So this void is really, in my opinion, looking back now with 25 years of hindsight to look at, this void is what helped, along with the other releases that came out in 91 that we're going to get to in a moment, which really spurred the change in musical landscape.
Yeah, and like you said, the fad, people didn't want to admit it at the time because it was fun. It was a thrill ride. Ask anybody who remembers the Sunset Strip in the 80s, and they never wanted it to end.
Well,
but like anything, it has to end.
It has to end, and it's another thing where, we talk about when you look at boy bands, you look at New Kids on the Block, One Direction, Backstreet Boys, your J-Biebs, your audience is going to grow out of what you are. So if you take the hair metal audience in 1985, who is probably, let's say, a 20-year-old, by 91 he's 26, hopefully has a job, probably has a family, priorities are a little different, or the kid who was 12 years old in 1985, by 91 he's 18, he's on the cusp of adulthood or going to college. So influences are going to change. Or you have people like, you know, I'll use you as an example. You had the older sibling who liked these bands, but growing up, then do you want to emulate the sibling or do you want your own?
And you're always going to look for trends. I think what was interesting about hair metal is it didn't get to be so popular because of metal fans. It got to be popular because people who were listening to pop music sort of liked what was happening. And then after 5 or 6 years, they found something else that caught their attention. I told you, I'm a living example of that. Where the old pictures of me from that era. I'm wearing black t-shirts. I tried to grow my hair out unsuccessfully, and then even I found myself saying,
"Did you get a perm?"
No.
Then I got you beat on that one.
Oh, really? My sister feathered my hair one time for school photos. But I think at the same time, I found myself kind of like, "Oh, what's this rap genre?" But where I saw the hair metal kind of getting a little stale, and it's a little repetitive. And I think what I find interesting about it is, and it's also Kaizen in 1991, is that you needed to see the evolution. And there wasn't really an evolution for hair metal because there was nowhere for it to go. It was just that one sound. I mean, the only way it could have gone would be bands like Metallica who never really ascribed to hair band, the model. And so they were just still metal. Or you got to find a way to say, what's going to be the next big thing? And there was a band that we've already discussed who put out a hair metal album in 1991, but in 1990, in November of 1990, they put out an album that they saw the next step, and it was Tesla, and they put out Five Man Acoustical Jam. They basically made a live acoustic album, and I think I was just looking it up. MTV Unplugged aired for the first time in November of '89, and so in '90 they had an episode here, episode there, and it was up to Tesla. I give them credit for basically saying how like, this isn't going to last for a lot longer. We better see what's next. And by November of 90, they put out that record. And I don't know about you, you still hear signs on the radio. Yeah. You know, what was so funny is I didn't even realize it was a cover. You know, and then you look on the rest of that album, they've also...
You listen to the entire album, because after the song is over, Jeff Keith, lead singer, says, Signs, an old song. I wish we would have written that song, but we didn't.
Oh, I see. I think it's cut off for the radio, right? Well, it wasn't until I got... My sister had the album, and I listened to it, and I saw, it's got Creedence's Lodi. Oh, it's got the Beatles' We Can Work It Out. It was like, there's a lot of cover songs on that. But then, in 1991, they said... Well, at least in 90... And I give them credit, because that was even ahead of the time. I mean, I guess maybe there would have been a handful of Unplugged episodes on at the time. Mm-hmm. And they said, this is the next big thing. Mm-hmm. And in April of 91 is when MTV Unplugged does their rap show.
Okay.
You've seen that footage of LL Cool J singing Mama Said Knock You Out with the guy playing acoustic guitar. And that was, MC Light, De La Soul, Tribe Called Quest were all at that Unplugged rap show. So you give them credit. It was so funny. It was a hair band who basically said, hey, we should do... an acoustic show, an acoustic album, and it sold a bunch, but it didn't. I mean, I think it was a very subtle revolution, right? It didn't spawn everybody to do that immediately, but then it kind of. I think it helped.
But I mean, there are
Unplugged.
Yeah, I think Unplugged obviously became a huge thing, and bands were doing it. Like, Poison did one.
Yeah.
Slaughter apparently did one, which I did not remember until interviewing them on their tour in '94, '95, where. Because they were putting out, MTV was putting out a CD-ROM of Unplugged stuff, and Slaughter was going to be on there. And they're like, you guys did an Unplugged? And they're like, yeah. And I'm like, I must have missed that one. If only I had DVR back then.
And the funny thing was, I'm pretty sure 1991 was also the year that REM did their Unplugged, and that was one of the biggest Unplugs of the time, you know. But yeah, like I said, it's so hair metal is sort of dwindling down.
Well, and even in hair metal, tangentially, the same, one of the bigger hits of a hair metal artist that was not a hair metal artist doing it. It was a cover song, another cover song. There was a band called The Party, which...
The Mickey Mouse Club?
They were from the Mickey Mouse Club. They put out an album called In the Meantime, In Between Time, which was to bridge the gap between their first album and their follow-up. Had a couple of remixes from their first album. They did a cover of Dawkins' In Your Dream or In My Dream.
Just the way it used to be.
which became a top 30 hit.
I vaguely remember that.
And, you know, they were on Club MTV performing it. It was probably, it's their biggest hit, mm-hmm. Even though their third album, Free, was produced by Dr. Dre.
Was it?
Yeah.
Chad Smart, listening to hair metal and the Mickey Mouse Club.
And the Mickey Mouse Club. So, yeah, and the Parties, again, their first, I mean, they're in a band that you would expect to be a pop band, which mm-hmm. you'd expect from one, but they're still a good band. And even the stuff that they've done since then, actually, I believe Chase Hampton is the only one who's put out an album following the demise of the Party, who are now kind of unofficially back together or whatever. But anyway, that's beside the point. Hair metal was just at that point where, like you said, it was time for something new to come along. Mm. And what came along?
I mean, did grunge come out of hair metal? Or was grunge just another... Was grunge like rap? Was it just another... Was it something that wasn't pop? And so, I mean... Because I'm sure that they're, you know, I remember you mentioned Pantera was the hair band, but then yet when they did Cowboys from Hell and stuff and they reestablished, were they more metal? When they were trying to be alternative? I remember when Far Beyond Driven came out, those videos were getting played on Alternative Nation, you know, even though it was like, wait, they were Headbangers Ball of the last album.
Yeah.
You know. But yeah, I think you can say, I mean, because grunge probably goes back to, you know, Mudhoney is always considered sort of the godfathers, right? And they were doing stuff in 89 and 90. Soundgarden was making albums in the late 80s that was sort of just metal, but it was just so focused on the Seattle region and it wasn't getting out. And so, but what took it? What took it out? Did it had to be Nirvana? I mean, Nirvana had to, you know, and that was their, and Nevermind was their second album, right? So they had already kind of been on these small record labels, and give credit to, would it be to Geffen? Who had the foresight to see Nirvana's first album and say, okay, we need to sign this band because we got one more album to make and they're going to be like a breakthrough. And that's going to be we're going to define the next genre, because were there hair metal bands on Geffen? I mean,
Guns N' Roses.
Was Guns N' Roses a Geffen artist? Yeah.
So I believe Nelson was on Geffen.
Nelson was also on Geffen.
I think, yeah.
Yeah.
But yeah, and you know, in 91 you had Nevermind came out. Pearl Jam's 10 came out, mm-hmm. Soundgarden's Bad Motor Finger, the Red Hot Chili Peppers' fifth album, Blood Sugar Sex Magik, came out late in the year, which I don't really consider grunge, but it's...
That generic alternative term, right? Yeah.
And as we were discussing earlier, like, this genre took over because Nirvana's Nevermind, or Smells Like Teen Spirit, was all over MTV. But was it all over MTV because it was popular, or because MTV wanted it to be popular? And that's where you go with a genre. You know, the big question is, what is the driving force in what's popular? Mm-hmm. Is it actually the audience, or...
Yeah, what is popular?
That is the million-dollar question. What is popular? Next time on Positive Cynicism, we will try to answer that question as we hopefully wrap up the series on 1991 Music in Review. And we will finally get around to answering that question that I posed at the beginning of the first part of this series, back on episode 19, about the grunge song that was inspired by a student committing suicide in front of his English class. Until next time, remember, do something positive, question everything.
This is a production of the Jittery Monkey Podcast Network. For more jittery shenanigans, go to jitterymonkey.com.